Thanks for that. No problem. It's after 7. I'm knackered. I'm going home. You should too. She left him standing there, scratching his head like he was lost. She knew how he felt. Chapter 28. The party was pounding along at a thunderous pace, even though it was still early in the evening. Bodies curled into each other, and a weedy aroma hung in the air. Katie Parker ran her tongue along the narrow script tattoo on Jason's neck. She'd missed all the New Year's Eve parties, but this one was making up for it. "I'm in love," she thought, as he pulled her head back and placed a spliff in between her lips. She inhaled. He then brought it to his own mouth, dragging in on the end of the taper. She felt like they were floating in each other's arms, oblivious to the band, making their own music. "Will you come to my house later?" Jason asked. Katie stared through the smoky haze. "I've got to go home. My mother was attacked last night. She'll be worried about me. Please."
"Whatever," Katie laughed.
The way she felt now, her mother could go to hell. Sitting down at last with a cup of tea, Lottie closed her eyes so she couldn't see the dirty dishes piled up on the counter. Immediately her phone rang.
"Lottie."
"I'm at home, Boyd. What do you want?"
"Guess what? I'm tired. I found out who Susan Sullivan's doctor was."
"How? Who?"
"I called into the pharmacy named on the prescription."
"About time."
"You'll never guess. Tell me."
"Go on, guess."
"I'm hanging up now, Boyd."
"Grumpy boots.
Hanging up." "Dr. Annabelle O'Shea."
Lottie put her cup on the floor. Her friend, Annabelle.
"You still there, Lottie? Do you want to talk?"
"To her. What do you think?"
"I'll leave it with you. Good night."
"Boyd?"
"Yes?"
"Thanks." Finishing the call, Lottie glanced at the clock. 8:45 p.m. Not too late. Dr. Annabelle O'Shea sat in a corner of the Brook Hotel bar, sipping red wine. Her image looked effortless, making Lottie feel ancient. Unable to halt a twinge of jealousy colouring her cheeks, she pulled off her jacket, hoping her t-shirt was clean. She groaned. It was the one she'd washed with a pair of Sean's black jeans.
"What happened to you?"
Annabelle asked, wide-eyed, inclining her head towards Lottie's face.
"My own stupidity. Some punk jumped me."
Lottie folded her jacket on the seat beside her. "Thanks for meeting me."
"Sorry I missed your call last night."
Annabelle spoke in a voice mirroring her look, sharp and succinct.
"What are you having to drink?"
"Sparkling water."
"You're looking gorgeous, as always."
Annabelle signalled to the barman. Her navy trouser suit sat snugly over a white silk shirt, and an eye-catching silver pendant hung round her neck. With her legs crossed at the ankles, shod in a ridiculous pair of Jimmy Choo boots, Annabelle could be a model. Blonde hair knotted high on top of her head looked natural, though Lottie knew it was not.
"Wise arse," Annabelle said. "You look terrible."
"Thanks."
"You know why I wanted to meet you?"
Her water arrived and she sipped it.
"Feeling guilty for all the times you stood me up over the last few months?"
Annabelle joked.
"It's hard to fit everyone in."
"How are the children?"
"They're fine. And the twins?"
Lottie hated small talk.
"They spent the Christmas revising for their junior certificate."
Lottie sighed.
How did everyone else get the conscientious, brainy children, while hers lounged around listening to music or twiddling their thumbs on a PlayStation?
"I suppose Super Dad is as efficient as always."
Lottie knew Kian O'Shea was the husband any woman would die for, though she suspected Annabelle didn't share that sentiment.
"Same old Kian, God's gift,"
Annabelle said with more than a hint of sarcasm.
"Lighten up. Without him working from home and running the house for you, you'd be lost."
That's the problem. He's always there. I never get a minute's peace. Can't even take a day off to stay at home, or he's fluffing the pillows and shunting the Hoover about the place. When he's not cleaning, he's working on his computer, designing God knows what type of games, sound-reducing headphones clamped on and singing at the top of his voice. Lottie smiled wryly. She would dearly love to hear Adam's voice again, even for a minute. Enough about me and my lot. How are you doing? Annabel asked pointedly. I could do with the prescription for more chill pills. Lottie, it's time to start facing up to reality. A rush of blood surged up Lottie's face. She didn't want a lecture. I want to talk about Susan Sullivan. Not yet, Annabel said, twisting round in her seat to face Lottie. I'm too busy for this right now, Lottie said. Is your mood affecting your work? Annabel persisted. No. I think the correct answer is yes. Let's ask the audience, Lottie said, but her flippancy wasn't working. Truthfully, I don't know, she added. I told you before, you need grief counselling.
Feck off,
Lottie said, only half joking. If you don't want to think about yourself, think of your children. You need to be in the right frame of mind to deal with their problems.
They're fine, Lottie emphasised. What problems?
She closed her eyes for a moment. No, they're not fine. I'm not fine. My house isn't fine, and I fell out with my mother. Annabel laughed.
Again? Good.
I always said she was a mad hatter without the tea party.
Ah, don't be so cruel.
She controls you. Always did. I've the upper hand now. She hasn't spoken to me in months. You might have the upper hand at the moment, but for how long?
I don't want to talk about her.
And the history she buried. Your dad, your brother. We're here to talk about Susan Sullivan, Lottie interrupted. She didn't want to go down that same old secret road. Since Adam died, you're not in a good place.
Mentally.
Emotionally, Annabel said and sipped her wine. Lottie put down her glass, picked it up again.
So, I'm depressed?
Grief. It clouds your judgment of the living as well as the dead. You need time out.
It's been 3 years. Everyone thinks I'm over, Adam.
Are you? Annabel raised an eyebrow. You'll never be fully over him. But you will learn to cope, and you need to be able to give 100% to your work. Can you do that?
I can give 110%, even if I'm knocking on the gates of hell.
Annabel sighed. Okay, I'll give you the prescription. Collect it from my office during the week. I shouldn't, but it's on condition you undergo a full medical and cut down on the narcotics.
Add a few sleepers to the script, Lottie chanced. Now you're pushing it.
When this case is over, I'll take a full medical. And counselling?
I just need the pills, Lottie said.
She'd decide when she was ready for counselling. She wanted the pills. They kept her head together. One day at a time. One pill at a time. Whatever it took to get through the day.
All right, Annabel said.
Relieved, Lottie switched the subject to the reason they were meeting. Tell me about Susan Sullivan.
God, I can't believe she was murdered. Here, in Redmullen.
Why?
What's that all about?
That's what I'm trying to find out. I don't think anything I tell you will be of help.
I'm trying to build up a picture of her. At this stage, I've no idea what may be relevant.
As she's dead, I presume I'm not breaking any doctor-patient confidentiality, Annabel said.
When was she diagnosed with cancer?
Lottie asked, dreading the memory the C-word conjured for her.
She was my patient for the last year. Presented with abdominal pain, so I sent her for a CT scan. It confirmed abnormalities on both ovaries, and a biopsy tested positive for ovarian cancer. Advanced stage. I informed her of this last June.
And her reaction?
Poor woman.
She just accepted it.
Like Adam, thought Lottie, clutching her glass tightly to stop her hand from shaking.
I felt sorry for her.
She'd such a hard life, Annabel said, taking a slow sip of her wine.
Oh?
I advised her to see a therapist. She refused. I encouraged her to talk to me, and she did, a little.
Tell me what she said.
She told me she had had a baby when she was still a child herself. Her mother, a terrible woman by all accounts, made her sign it away. Susan was obsessed with finding the child. She even... Annabel looked away for a moment, biting her lip.
What? Go on, Lottie urged.
Well, I suppose since Susan's dead, I can say. She approached your mother about it.
My mother?
Lottie was astounded. She hadn't seen her mother in almost 4 months. Rose was the last person she expected to be talking about.
Why on earth would she do that?
Because your mother helped deliver the baby. Lottie sat back, feeling a little dull-witted.
Of course.
Her mother, a midwife, now retired, had delivered many babies born in and around Ragmullen. She concluded Susan had grown up in Ragmullen.
That's certainly interesting, Lottie said.
And do you know how she got on with her?
You should ask your mum yourself.
Maybe I'll have to, Lottie said. Did Susan have any next of kin? Her mother died a few years ago. I don't think she had anyone.
Lottie sat thinking. A television channel was broadcasting a soccer match, the sound muted, like her mind.
Did Susan ever talk about how she got pregnant? Who the father was?
Annabel was silent.
Are you going to tell me?
Lottie probed, tearing pieces off a beer mat, hoping against hope. It might have something to do with why she was murdered.
She was only a child at the time, maybe only 12 years old.
All she'd tell me was that she was systematically raped from a very young age.
Her father? Could he have done it?
Lottie, I don't know who did it to her. She never told me.
Did you advise her to report it?
I did, but she wouldn't hear of it. Said it was too long ago and that she'd had enough to sort out in the time she'd left. I couldn't convince her otherwise.
I find it hard to understand how Susan coped all those years.
She wasn't always called Susan Sullivan, Annabel said.
What?
Lottie put down her glass with a thump.
Who? How?
I don't know what she was called before. I can only surmise that she changed her name in an attempt to obliterate her early years. Annabel smiled sadly. But changing your name cannot change the hurt. Susan carried that pain around with her every day of her life. I think she found the cancer diagnosis something of a welcome release.
And then someone decided to hasten her entry to the next world, Lottie said.
She suddenly felt too warm.
Indeed.
Now it's my job to find out who and why. Lottie churned the new information over in her mind.
And you will, Nancy Drew.
Did you know I called you that behind your back at school?
I knew.
Lottie wished they could talk about old times and what they remembered as good times. Memory was a strange thing, warping the past. She had learned that from experience.
I'm sorry I can't be of more help, Annabel said.
You've given me something to go on.
Lottie put down her glass and looked directly at her friend.
What are you going to do about Keane?
He's driving me up the walls and back down again.
Honestly, Annabel, why?
Fucked if I know, Annabel said.
She rarely swore, but she could get away with it. Lottie knew Annabel O'Shea could get away with just about anything.
I'd say it's something to do with your mystery man.
Since I met... Annabel paused. I'm a different person since I met the man I'm now in love with.
You were always falling in and out of love.
Who is he?
You're my friend, but I think it's best you remain clueless, I'm clueless, all right. About more than your lover boy.
Chapter 29. Katie draped her arms around Jason's neck and pulled him into her body.
I'm freezing.
I'll keep you warm. Just wait till I get you into bed.
You're a creep,
she joked. He hugged her tighter and she felt a soft flutter in her stomach as he feathered her neck with his lips. Over his shoulder, she surveyed the noisy crowd behind them queuing for taxis.
Don't look now, but remember that creepy fart who was watching us in the pub the other night?
What about him? He mumbled.
He's in the queue.
It's a free country.
Jason turned round and leaned into the freezing air.
Where is he?
I told you not to look.
Katie dragged him back.
Now he's gone.
The invisible man, Jason laughed.
It's not funny. He's freaking me out.
If you see him again, tell me.
Katie snuggled deeper into his arms and waited patiently with Jason for the elusive taxi. Somehow, she didn't feel safe. The man quickened his step once he turned the corner. That had been a close one. He was sure the girl had spotted him. He would have to be more careful in future. But it had been worth it, just to see the boy.
Lottie couldn't sleep. Again. Her conversation with Annabelle wrestled within her brain and confused into a knot. Her mother. The one woman who had the power to conjure up tortured memories.
Lottie closed her eyes tight. But she couldn't dim the image of Rose Fitzpatrick. Tomorrow she would have to see her. Leaning over the side of the bed, she notched up the electric blanket, nestled deeper beneath the duvet, snuggled into the artificial warmth and drifted into an uncomfortable sleep. 10 minutes later, she was awake. Pain cut through her ribs and her brow was on fire. She swallowed 2 painkillers. The pain wouldn't desist. The events of the day were invading her night, the past clawing its way into her present. She needed a drink. She really needed a drink. She needed a real drink. Scrunching the duvet into a ball, Lottie didn't want to revert to the unrecognizable person she'd been after Adam's death. To a time when she screwed her mouth to the neck of a wine bottle and the wine almost screwed her. Until she beat it 1 year ago. Still, sometimes she yearned to escape into oblivion. That desire obliterated all sense, and she struggled to regain a semblance of normality. Struggling now, she fought it ferociously, twisting and turning, and eventually she lost the battle. She jumped out of the bed. Pulling a hoodie over her pajamas, Lottie thrust bare feet into her Uggs and tiptoed down the stairs. The kitchen clock said 1:30 a.m. She took the key from the hook behind the back door and walked out onto the snow-covered garden to the shed. She wiped the white clumps from the lock. It was frozen underneath. A sign to go back to bed? She breathed on the brass. Stopped. Almost gave up. Tried again. It opened. Flicking on the light switch, she lifted down Adam's toolbox and opened it. She eyed the bottle of vodka, closed the lid and sat on the cold floor. One drink was never enough. She bit her thumbnail and chewed. After a few tormented minutes staring at the toolbox, she opened it again, removed the vodka, closed the lid, and with the bottle tucked under her arm, hurried back to the house, leaving the shed door swinging in the cold night wind. 1st of January, 1975. She could not believe it. He was sitting on their floral couch, in their sitting room, staring at her, while her mammy fussed with china cups and biscuits. Her daddy puffed loudly on his pipe, acrid smoke filling the void between him and the priest. Her eyes bulged in protest. They were discussing her problem. Like she wasn't even there.
With the tea towel in her knickers filling up with blood and goo, she held the little baby in her arms and wondered how she hadn't known it had been growing inside her. She smiled, thinking it was a perfect baby, though the priest called it a fat sin with arms and legs. How could he sit there and say such a thing? She desperately wanted to tell them, to tell her mammy, standing there with the gold-rimmed teapot in her hand, and her daddy, sitting like a fucking idiot with his penknife chopping flakes off a tobacco bar, to tell them it was all the priest's fault. She said nothing. Her heart was breaking into tiny pieces. She held her baby wrapped in nothing other than a towel for a nappy. She had wanted to tell that woman, the midwife. With her smooth face and curled hair, she'd cut the cord and checked the baby's heart and whispered to her mammy to stop shouting. Almost as soon as she had arrived, she was gone. And now they were talking as if she was invisible. The baby whimpered. Her tiny breast buds leaked, staining her shirt. She began to cry, and they all gawked at her. She clamped the baby to her chest. Fear, for herself and her little one, streaked through every vein in her body.
St. Angela's, the priest said. That will put manners on her.
Day 4, 2nd of January 2015. Chapter 30. A man's leg was lying across her, pinning her to the bed. Who was he? Where was she? Twisting as best she could, Lottie looked but couldn't see his face. He was lying on his stomach. Raising herself onto her elbow, she winced with pain, and with it came a sudden memory flash. Shit, shit, shit! She'd been drinking. She felt the tiny gumdrop tears edging out of the corner of her eyes, and self-hate rose with the rotten bile lurching up from her stomach. She was going to puke. Kicking up her legs, she dislodged his, slid out of the bed and crawled towards an open door. She reached the toilet in time to throw up. The rancid smell of alcohol filled the bathroom as she heaved once more before settling onto her haunches. Dressed only in her mismatched underwear, she didn't care and sat there cradling her pounding head in her hands. She only cared that she'd lost control at a time when she needed to be in total control. A shadow fell across the doorway, then the light flicked on, blinding her.
Would you like a cigarette?
Void. She cried in earnest then. She couldn't help herself. She hated herself. What have I done? She asked, averting her eyes from his. He eased his long body, clad only in boxer shorts, to sit beside her on the cold tiled floor.
You were drunk and rang me to come and get you, which I did. You begged me to bring you here. Then you propositioned me.
He lit two cigarettes, passed one into her quivering fingers.
Against my baser instincts, I resisted your cajoling. By that stage you weren't capable of anything other than sleep, apart from forcibly undressing me.
She inhaled deeply, mortification flushing her skin.
Lottie, what's going on?
Boyd asked, blowing smoke circles in the chill air.
I haven't a notion.
You need help.
I need to get a grip on my life.
You can't do this on your own.
Watch me, she said. I am, and I don't like what I'm seeing.
What does that mean? He inhaled his cigarette. Silence wrapped itself around them.
You were crying in your sleep, he said eventually.
I'll be fine, she said. They sat and smoked to the sound of the toilet dripping. Then he dampened the butts under the tap, threw them in a shiny bin under the sink, and led her back to his bed. He tucked her in, kissed her forehead, fluttered his hand through her hair and slid in beside her. Lottie hung onto the edge of the bed, creating an imaginary line between them before falling into a soft sleep. She awoke and sat upright, alone. She twisted the clock to see the time, 6:38 a.m. Nestling back down into the comfort of the pillow, Lottie was thankful it was Boyd she had imposed her drunken self on, and not some faceless bar pickup. Her children. Shit. She jumped up abruptly. She had to get home before they woke. Boyd walked in, fully dressed in black trousers with white shirt, and handed her a mug of coffee. The aroma tingled at the base of her nose. She looked into his eyes, questioning him silently.
Don't worry. I can be discreet. Drink up. We've a long day ahead of us.
You're a good man, she said. Thank you.
You've 5 minutes to wash and dress, he said, and walked out of the room.
Sadist, she said.
It takes one to know one,
Boyd's voice echoed. She had to smile. She pulled on yesterday's clothes. At least she'd the sense to have changed out of her pajamas last night. Finding a crushed Xanax in the back pocket of her jeans, she stuffed it into her mouth and washed it down with two gulps of coffee. She needed the artificial calmness to delete the night and face the day. She picked up the pack of cigarettes and secreted them in her pocket. She only smoked when drunk. Do not go there, she warned herself, and left the bedroom. Outside, the sleet blitzed the cuts on her face before she ducked into the car. Drop me home first, she said. I have to check in on the kids and change my clothes. The swishing of the wipers was the only sound in the car. Neither had much to say to each other, and that which they were thinking was probably best left unsaid. Boyd pulled up outside her house. She hoisted her long legs out of the car. Thanks, Boyd.
What'll I tell Corrigan if he looks for you?
Tell him I'm following up a lead.
What lead?
When I figure it out, I'll tell you. She closed the door with a soft thud. Time to resurrect strong Lottie. Before it was too late. Chapter 31 Chloe Parker sat at the table, mascara streaking her damp cheeks. Lottie stalled at the door. Go in or run? I'm sorry, Chloe, she said, entering the kitchen. The girl ignored her, walked over to the bin, extracted the 2/3 empty vodka bottle, unscrewed the cap, emptied the remaining third down the sink, dumped the bottle back in the bin, and ran up the stairs. Lottie slumped into her chair. She'd have to talk to Chloe. Later. She phoned her mother, knowing Rose would relish the fact that it was Lottie breaking their deadlock. She convinced herself that being in the throes of a raging hangover might help rather than hinder the forthcoming showdown. It had taken less than 10 minutes for Rose Fitzpatrick to drive across town. Now she stood at the ironing board, iron in hand, in the middle of the kitchen floor.
Lottie Parker, you should stay at home more often. Those poor children are always starving and they haven't a stitch to wear, she said, folding Sean's training jersey.
Lottie wanted to tell Rose that the sports top didn't need ironing, but she held the thought. As she suspected she would, her mother had taken control the minute she entered the house, without question or inquiry. Following Adam's death, Rose had tried to take his place in their lives, interfering and controlling. Lottie suspected all this was grounded in love for her grandchildren and wrapped up in a protective streak which Rose nurtured. But everything had come to a head with their last row when Lottie had told her mother to take a hike, or words to that effect. Standing tall, sweeping the iron over the clothes, Rose Fitzpatrick's face was a map of smoothness, with just a creeper of lines at her eyes, like wilting ivy. Her hair was short, sharp, and silver. At one time, a monthly hair colour woman, She'd abandoned this on turning 70, 5 years ago, though she still went to the salon for a weekly wash and blow-dry.
"Will I make a cup of tea?"
Lottie asked politely.
"It's your kitchen,"
Rose said, running the iron along a pair of jeans, the denim like cardboard.
"Would you like a cup?"
Lottie refilled the kettle.
"You take a shower." Rose folded the iron flex. "You smell, you know? Then you can ask me whatever it is you want to be here for."
Lottie stormed out of the kitchen. Her mother hadn't even asked how she got her bruised face. She stripped off her clothes and stood under a stream of hot water until it stung her cuts. Her ribs were purple and her head ached, but at least she felt clean. Pulling on a thermal vest and long-sleeved t-shirt over her jeans, she felt ready to face her. Before going downstairs, she peered into Chloe's room. Her daughter was lying on the bed, a massive set of earphones on her head. When she spotted Lottie, the girl purposefully turned to the wall. Glancing into Katie's room, she saw it was empty. She thought of asking Chloe where her sister was, but decided against it. Sean was in his room, talking on an online PlayStation game. He'd probably been up all night. In the kitchen, Rose was sitting at the table holding a cup of tea. The ironing board was gone, clothes neatly piled. Potatoes were hissing in a pot on the cooker. A chicken was roasting in the oven, and it was not yet 8 o'clock in the morning. Christmas Day. That was the last time they had a proper cooked dinner. Was this an orchestrated guilt trip by her mother? Lottie forced a smile.
Thanks for...
Lottie directed her arm around the tidy kitchen.
Isn't that what mothers are for? Rose said. Cleaning up the mess their children leave behind.
The smile died on Lottie's lips.
So, what do you want with me?
Rose asked.
Susan Sullivan,
Lottie said, diving straight in. She poured herself a cup of tea.
The murdered woman? What about her?
I spoke with Annabelle and she told me Susan contacted you.
She did.
And you met her?
Yes, a few months ago. October, November maybe. I'm not sure when.
Go on.
She was trying to trace a child that was taken from her.
What had that to do with you? Lottie interjected.
Do you want to hear or not?
Sorry, continue. Susan's mother had refused to tell her anything about the baby. But on her deathbed 2 years ago, she mentioned my name.
And?
She said I'd helped deliver the baby, which wasn't true, because I'd arrived shortly after the birth. I couldn't help her back then, nor when she contacted me for information. Lottie twisted the spoon in her tea.
It must be more than 25 years since...
I was a midwife.
Yes, but this was way back, in the '70s. The girl was only aged about 11 or 12, a child, poor thing. Her name was Sally Steins then.
Really? Tell me more. Lottie stopped her idle stirring. Maybe now they could get something new with Susan's old name.
Not much to tell.
What happened to the baby?
When she called me, Susan stirred up old memories, Rose said, a frown creasing a line on her brow. Her mother had called in a priest, a local curate. Apparently, he suggested placing the girl and her baby in St. Angela's. You know, the old building not far from the graveyard. Closed down now.
Lottie nodded. St. Angela's. How could she forget? They never spoke about it. But Rose was talking now.
It was originally an orphanage run by the nuns. Then it combined into a home for unmarried girls. Obviously some of the unwanted babies grew up there. The nuns also took in wayward boys.
A place to send wayward children, Lottie murmured. That's one way of putting it, Mother. Rose ignored Lottie's remark.
Of course, when she met me, Susan already knew about St. Angela's and the fact that the baby was probably adopted. She remembered spending time there, but she couldn't get any information from the church about her baby. Unfortunately, I had nothing new to tell her.
Rose said with a steely resolve. Did you know who fathered her baby?
No idea.
When I was in the house helping with the afterbirth, her mother was shouting at the girl, calling her a little tramp. It was very distressing. But if the girl was a tearaway, the father could have been anyone.
Rose folded her arms tightly. Lottie recoiled from her mother's harshness and mulled over her revelations. Hopefully they would have more success finding out about Susan, a.k.a. Sally Steins. It was a coincidence that her mother had this information. Small-town people carry such secrets around with them all their lives. Coincidences were inevitable. And then again, her mother knew everyone and liked to think she knew everything. Lottie sipped her tea. A memory, deeply concealed, itched to be released. Do you ever wonder about Eddie? Lottie asked, feeling brave enough to pose the question about her brother. Rose stood up, rinsed her cup, dried it, and put it in the rightful place in the cupboard.
Eddie is gone. Don't talk about him, she said.
Denial, thought Lottie, but she persisted.
And Dad, can we talk about him? The chicken will be cooked in another half hour. Watch the water doesn't boil off the spuds.
Rose pulled on her coat and hat.
You can heat everything up in the microwave for dinner this evening.
I suppose we can talk about them then, Lottie said wryly.
You need a man in your life, Lottie Parker,
Rose said, hand on the door.
What?
Asked Lottie, wrong-footed.
Boyd, is that his name? The long, skinny one. Nice man.
What do you mean?
You know right well what I mean. And bring those kiddies to visit soon.
Lottie wasn't keeping them away. They had made that decision themselves, that they'd had enough of their meddling grandmother.
On the doorstep, Rose said, By the way, I saw your interview on the news.
And?
Not very impressive, madam.
She drew her hat over her ears.
You could have masked those bruises with a touch of makeup.
As always, her mother got in the last word. Lottie slammed the door. She turned off the cooker, drained the potatoes and dumped them in the pedal bin. She threw out the chicken too. She was damned if she was going to eat anything prepared by her domineering mother. She would rather starve. Her hangover was pulsating now, but she had to go to work. Chapter 32. As the morning sleet eased, the temperatures rose unexpectedly.
Listen to that,
Garda Gillian O'Donoghue said.
To what?
Asked Garda Tommy Tierney.
Snow melting. The sound was like a forest of hummingbirds, such was the intensity of the thaw. They were standing at the door of James Brown's cottage.
Positively balmy, Tierney said. A warm plus one beats minus 10 on New Year's Eve.
I'm going for a walk around the garden. My feet are in a state of perpetual frozenness, O'Donoghue said.
Is that even a proper word?
Who cares? She laughed, and headed along the path to the back garden, enthralled by the greenery being slowly exposed through the shifting snow. The white beauty had been magical for the first few days until it became an unbearable burden. She breathed in the cool air and listened to the thaw. As she turned, a snatch of colour under a tree caught her eye. She walked toward it, then backed away, shouting,
Tom! Tom!
A hand, cuffed in black, protruded from the snow. O'Donoghue reached for the radio pinned to her chest. By the time Lottie and Boyd arrived, the garden was a scene of organised commotion. Lottie groaned. This was more work in 3 days than they'd seen in the last 2 years. She hadn't even had time to get her head around her mother's revelations. Boyd and Maria Lynch had met her on the station steps with the news, and they'd driven to James Brown's house as quickly as the slush allowed. She walked with Lynch around the back, both keeping their eyes peeled for any evidence that might be exposed. Boyd spoke to the uniformed officers. Lottie spotted the Socco's team leader, Jim McGlynn. He smirked.
The bastard, Lottie said.
Who?
Asked Lynch.
McGlynn. He was laughing at her. Pity he wasn't under her command. She'd have him sifting pig shit for the rest of his working life, looking for invisible dioxins. The garden was compact. A shed and a wooden table with chairs leaning against it occupied the patio area to the left of the back door. Evergreen trees bordered two sides of the enclosure, a wall at the end, and snowy fields beyond. McGlynn worked the area, painstakingly removing snow and revealing the victim. Lottie waited. Eventually the body was fully exposed. Male, face down, clothed in a black jacket and trousers. The visible hand appeared wrinkle-free, with a silver ring. Pieces of glass and black plastic were scattered around and over the body. McGlynn was picking them up with tweezers and placing them in an evidence bag. A phone? Lottie asked.
Smashed to bits, he said. I doubt even our best technicians will get anything from it.
How long has the body been here?
I'm waiting for the state pathologist, McGlynn answered sharply.
Prick, Lottie said under her breath. Jane Dore breezed onto the site, suited up in her protective gear, and acknowledged Lottie with a swift shake of her head.
Someone must think I've nothing to do. They keep supplying me with bodies.
Agreed, Lottie said, standing to one side while the pathologist carried out her preliminary examination.
Appears to be strangulation, Jane said. There's a ligature mark on his neck. On initial observation, I can determine frozen snow under the body. It's quite possible he was killed within the last week. The Arctic temperatures have preserved him in perfect condition.
Perfect condition, except he is dead, thought Lottie. She felt like puking, her hangover unrelenting. Do you think this is the crime scene? She asked, and realized if the body had been here a week, the man had been killed prior to the Sullivan and Brown deaths.
I'll know more when I get him on my table.
And you'll inform me if he has a tattoo?
Of course,
the pathologist said, and with short, careful steps left the scene. Lottie's headache intensified. The body count was rising. Corrigan was boiling. The press were baying. The public were terrified and her team were no nearer any explanation for all or any of the murders. Welcome to La La Land, Inspector Parker. She scratched her head. Fucking hell.
You okay?
Boyd was at her shoulder.
Who is he?
She asked.
How do I know?
She bit back a retort and looked at Boyd. His face seemed thinner, if that were possible. It was a rhetorical question. The victim was more than likely killed before Sullivan and Brown. With the body turned over onto his back, Lottie looked at the bloated, blackened face. I'd estimate mid-30s, she said, and watched patiently as the Soccos bagged the body and removed it from the scene. McGlynn held up a small plastic evidence bag.
Blue fibre, Lottie noted.
From around the neck, he said.
Thanks, Lottie said. Similar rope to that wound round James Brown's neck.
No wallet or identification, but there are two cigarette ends here, McGlynn said, picking up one with tweezers.
Belonging to the victim?
Possibly. Or his killer.
He dropped it into an evidence bag. Lottie watched McGlynn at work for a few minutes before going into the house.
That body isn't a million miles from the description we have of Father Angelotti, Boyd said, trailing her inside.
The face is unrecognisable and we've no record of distinguishing marks to check for, Lottie said. We'll have to wait for formal identification. Otherwise, it's down to DNA analysis.
Whoever he is, someone has to be missing him.
There's no car, Lottie remarked, looking out the front window. How did he get out here?
Maybe the killer drove him or he got a taxi, Boyd said.
Why was he here?
That's another question.
And did Brown know him?
We have too many questions and not enough answers, Boyd said.
Find out what you can.
He
He could have been Brown's lover boy. He drove him here and killed him in a jealous rage, Boyd ventured.
I suppose now you think Brown killed this man, strangled Sullivan, then hung himself.
Lottie shook her head in annoyance. Boyd said nothing, pulled out another cigarette and went outside to light it. Following him, Lottie stepped into the slushy yard. Her brain was a muddle. She could do with a drink. She settled for one of Boyd's cigarettes and told him about the conversation with Dr. Annabel O'Shea and her mother.
Chapter 33. At the station, they added the unknown victim and details from the scene to the incident board. Lottie supported the theory whereby visually interpreting data was more productive than information in databases which could be missed or forgotten. Not that they had much to interpret. She assigned the task of resurrecting information on Sally Steins, a.k.a. Susan Sullivan, to a detective, and wondered where she could get her hands on St. Angela's records. Discovering more about the institution just might reveal something about Susan Sullivan. Lottie returned her attention to the latest victim. "If it hadn't snowed so heavily," she said, "the body might have been found."
"A week ago," Boyd interjected.
"Yes. Unless the killer was following the weather forecast, he wanted that body found. And there was no attempt to cover it up. Just the snow."
"If it hadn't snowed," Boyd began.
"But it did. Was it an attempt to point the finger at James Brown?
When the body wasn't found, for some reason, the murderer had to kill Sullivan and Brown." Boyd paused, then continued.
"Brown could still have carried out this murder, though." "Oh, this conjecture is pointless," Lottie sighed with exasperation.
Looking at the board, she noticed they had no photograph of Father Angelotti. She made a quick phone call, grabbed her coat, and sidestepping Boyd, hurried out of the building.
"Hello, sister. I'm here to see Father Burke. He's expecting me."
The nun directed her to the room where she'd sat the first day. Lottie walked around the mahogany furniture, looking at the large portraits of long-dead bishops hanging on the walls. "They put the fear of God in you," she thought.
"Wouldn't they put the fear of God in you?" Father Joe said, walking in behind her.
"I was thinking the exact same thing," she grinned at him.
"Synchronicity?"
"Tea?"
"Sister Anna will oblige."
"No, thank you."
"How can I help?" It sounded urgent on the phone.
"I need a photograph of Father Angelotti,"
Lottie said.
She didn't really need it.
They had the hairbrush for DNA comparisons.
"You haven't found him yet?"
He went to a computer in the corner where he'd printed a photograph. She could have done that herself. Wasn't it just an excuse to see him again? She shouldn't have come here. Her logic and emotions were contradictory. So was she. Studying the photo, she wrinkled up her nose. It was possible he was the body in Brown's garden.
"Does Father Angelotti smoke?"
she asked, recalling the stale tobacco smell in the priest's room and the cigarette butts at the scene.
"I don't know," he said. "Hold on."
He phoned someone, listened, and hung up. "According to Father Owen, Bishop Connor's secretary, he did smoke.
Why do you need to know?"
"Gathering as much information as possible." She switched the conversation.
"What do you know about St. Angela's?"
"St. Angela's? Not a lot. It ceased operating as a children's home in the early 80s. I think it was a retirement place for nuns before it closed permanently. It was sold a few years ago."
"What happened to the records?"
"I presume they were archived," he said.
"Why the questions about St. Angela's?"
"How would I go about finding out where the records are?"
Lottie ignored his query.
"All very mysterious, Inspector, but leave it with me. I can do some amateur detecting for you." Lottie caught a glint of mischief in his eye and thought she saw the boy he once was, before the white collar of Rome shackled him to austere adulthood. She rose to leave, holding out her hand.
He seemed to hold it for a second longer than necessary. Or was it her imagination?
You have my number. Let me know as soon as you find anything, she said.
Of course I will.
Father Joe searched the diocesan records on the local area network, using his personal password. He keyed in St. Angela's. Access denied.
Unusual.
He rang Father Owen.
I seem to be having difficulty finding the diocesan record database, he said.
Bishop Connor engaged a consultant to revamp our intranet. He wanted increased security.
But surely these records are available to us priests?
You can have my password. See if it gets you in.
I'm sure Bishop Connor won't mind.
You're a lifesaver.
Hanging up, he entered the new password. He was in. He looked at the cursor flashing on the blank screen. There were no records relating to St. Angela's. He grabbed for his phone again.
Chapter 34.
You what?
Boyd exploded when Lottie told him where she'd been.
Have you lost your mind? What's your problem?
He's sure to have avenues we don't know about. Why was she justifying her actions to Boyd?
You're still drunk, he said. That's the only logical conclusion.
Lower your voice, Lottie said, looking around to see who was listening to the interchange. Lynch and Kirby were keeping their heads studiously down.
He's a suspect in the Sullivan murder.
Boyd paced, his long legs carrying him from wall to wall in three strides. Her headache intensified with each step he hammered on the floor.
I didn't tell him why I wanted the records, or for that matter what records I was looking for. I need to know of their existence and current whereabouts.
For argument's sake. If he is the murderer, he either knows there's something you want in those records and will destroy them, if they're not already destroyed, or if he didn't know before, now he does, and will destroy them anyway.
You're talking pure shite, Boyd.
She pulled out a chair and flopped down.
What do you want with them anyway?
He asked, standing in front of her.
I don't know.
She wished she was back in her own office. At least there she could think without an audience. The records may have nothing to do with our case. It's just a hunch at this stage. Ticking boxes, she said.
Speaking of boxes, did you take my spare cigarettes this morning?
Boyd asked, throwing an empty packet in the bin. Lottie dug the box out of her pocket and threw it at him. He caught it and marched out the door.
Lynch?
Inspector? I'm going out for a while. Lottie was convinced Ragmullen Cemetery was the coldest place in Ireland. The icy wind swirled around her and the cold sun cast a shimmering mist through the headstones. Eerie monoliths, standing in the shade of large pine trees, flung deep shadows on the graves, slowing the thaw. Crystallized snow, frosted to Christmas wreaths, added an unlikely mystical feel to the surroundings. The wind increased momentarily and rustled the plastic wrapping on a poinsettia potted plant. The red head, blackened and wilting under the weight of snow, was a reminder that someone had visited to leave a token for those no longer alive, but living on in a memory. A tall granite cross marked the four short decades Adam had spent in this world. She hadn't visited for some time, avoided it at Christmas, and now, with the solitude of the cemetery wrapping itself around her like a threadbare shawl providing little comfort, Lottie apologized to Adam.
It's too lonely here,
she told the stone cross. I keep you in my heart. She squinted around at the other tombstones with their stories hidden deep within hewn granite. A chime tinkled in the stillness and a chill traversed her spine. Time to go. She had secrets to unearth and a killer to catch. As she walked out through the open gates, Lottie noticed the silhouette of St. Angela's, across the field about a mile in the distance, shrouded in a soft grey mist. What skeletons lay buried deep within its walls? How many lives had it damaged? She thought of Susan and her baby. She remembered another child who had disappeared a long time ago. Was he dead? Would he ever rest within the grounds of a cemetery? Was that missing boy the real reason she wanted to see the old records? She wasn't at all sure of her motives. But she knew she could never forget that child. He was missing so long. Others may have forgotten about him, but she hadn't. Her constant checking of his file was more than an exercise in memory. It was a means of keeping him deeply planted in her mind. The day she joined the guard as Shiokana, following in her late father's footsteps, she had promised herself she would find him. So far, she had failed in delivering on that promise. She hurried back to her car, before the ghosts of the past rested heavier on her shoulders.
Chapter 35.
Lottie sat with Boyd in front of bank manager Mike O'Brien. She'd taken an instant dislike to the man the moment he'd sat down behind his desk without as much as a hello. But Boyd knew him. They shared the same gym and coached Ragmullen's underage hurling team. Lottie wondered if he'd ever trained Sean. She knew Boyd had.
"You have the Brown and Sullivan bank statements," O'Brien said. "So, what else do you want from me?"
His small eyes reminded Lottie of a ferret her son had once attempted to bring home as a pet, dark and shifty. She had the feeling that O'Brien was trying to second-guess her, puffing out his chest and desperately failing to make himself look important. Dandruff, from his too long grey hair speckled down the shoulders of his black suit. Diamond cufflinks sparkled at his wrists, glittering under the fluorescent lighting. Here was a man trying to look half his age, only succeeding in looking older. Tough shit, O'Brien. But as he had led them into his office a moment ago, she had noticed his quick, athletic stride. Hours in the gym paid off for some people. If you have the time, she told herself. Detective Sergeant Boyd analysed the victim's bank statements, Lottie said.
We need to know where the money was coming from, Boyd said.
What do you mean?
O'Brien's eyes darted between the two detectives.
There are amounts of up to €5,000 hitting their accounts regularly over the last 6 months, Boyd said.
Almost 30,000 each, Lottie said. Who was giving it to them?
That's none of your business, O'Brien said, a hint of arrogance sharpening his tone.
Let me be the judge of that, Lottie said. These people were murdered, and this money appears to come from one account into both of theirs. I need you to tell me who paid it.
No,
O'Brien answered, twisting the diamonds tighter into his cuffs.
No what?
Lottie raised her voice.
No, I can't tell you.
O'Brien straightened his tie. The dandruff on his shoulder seemed to intensify, and a sweaty odour oozed from his armpits. These two people are dead, Lottie thumped the table.
Release the information or...
Or what, Inspector?
O'Brien flashed a smug smile. Or I'll get a warrant. Lottie stood.
You do that.
O'Brien pushed back his chair and stood up also. He was half a foot smaller than Lottie, and maybe 10 to 15 years older than her. Mark my words, Mr. O'Brien, we will be back, she warned.
You have their bank statements. I can't do anything else within the law.
Don't lecture me about the law.
Believe me, I wasn't trying to.
Lottie stepped towards O'Brien and looked down at him. I'm beginning to think this town is full of stonewalling, obstructive little shits, she hissed.
See you at the gym later,
O'Brien said with a short wave to Boyd, snubbing Lottie.
Maybe,
Boyd said, turning to leave.
Sweaty little bollocks,
Lottie muttered, and followed Boyd out of the office.
Language, Inspector, Boyd said.
I can't believe you actually share a gym with him.
And he coaches Ragmullen under 12 hurlers.
Thank God Sean now plays under 16.
O'Brien's not all that bad, Boyd laughed.
Could have fooled me.
With a swing of her shoulders, Lottie Power walked up the street ahead of Boyd. Chapter 36. As the